Empire podcast this week. Things get a little weird, a little creepy, and yet strangely beautiful, because Tim Burton is visiting the pod booth to talk about Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children. And no, we are not all graduates, thank you very much. We got kicked out for being too peculiar. Hello, pod. I'm Helen O'Hara, and welcome to the Empire podcast. Back in the studio after the live podcast last week, because the O2 insisted that we leave, please and thank you, and stop talking over the Monday night screening of Bridget Jones's Baby. Personally, I think people were loving it, but I guess there's no accounting for taste. Your regular host, Chris Hewitt, is currently away on a top secret mission having to do with the essence of wetness, so I'm covering for him in the hot seat this week, so apologies for that. As ever, I'm joined by two colleagues of such lethal cunning. First up is our art house guru, who spent this week fascinated by the debate that has everyone talking, whether Toy Story is really secretly a remake of Tokyo Story. It's Phil DeSemlin.
Hello!
Hello.
Hello.
So yes, that was the big debate this week.
Was
I
it?
I think I can agree. Yeah, I mean, I don't think there were any other debates that anybody in the world was talking about.
Don't think so.
No, that's probably
shouldn't have thought so.
Probably right.
Is that true?
No, I don't think so.
Did you just make that up? Because it's got the word story in it.
I'll be honest, I got to this morning and I didn't really have an intro for you and I just tried to think of art house films.
So, good.
Yeah.
If in doubt, go Ozu.
Well, you did. I mean, it seems like a word to live by. I've actually just been reading Silence, so I think I've got like Japan on the mind.
Right. Yeah. Silence is the new Martin Scorsese film, which is officially going to be coming out in cinemas
soon.
At some point.
Yes, it is. It's exciting, isn't it?
Is that news? I think we were expecting that if Martin Scorsese made a film, it would appear in cinemas at some point.
That somebody would release it. Yeah, but it's exciting that it's coming this soon.
And yeah.
Because that's something he's been working on for 20
How
years.
Soon?
So a couple of months.
Cool.
Yeah.
Okay.
Anyway, hello. We have one more colleague, and it is our soundtrack siren, a woman who can spot a theremin at 1,000 paces and who considers Michael Giacchino's punny titles the highest form of film art. It's Emma Thrower.
Hi. And that is true. I do consider them the highest form.
Yeah. There is no question, I guess.
No.
I mean, it's like Ozu number two, mm-hmm. and then like Michael Giacchino's punny titles
Absolutely.
Number one. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay.
We nearly made Phil do a spit take. That was so close. Mm-hmm. Oh, you just missed it. Mm. Okay, time for the question this week. We only have time for one because we've got about a bajillion reviews to do. This one comes from Gethin Moggs. As someone who has just finished Freshers Week, congratulations, what are the best university or college-based films?
Mm.
Yeah, so Gethin, who's presumably somewhere nursing a hangover.
Asleep.
Or asleep. or frantically trying to figure out... basically, I had a Freshers Day and then they threw us work. So maybe Gethin is already working very hard. Literally. We got there on Tuesday afternoon.
Yeah.
They gave us our first piece of work on Thursday morning.
That's outrageous. In fact, I think that's illegal. Where did you go to university? Oh, I know where you went to university. Oh, that explains so much.
Yeah.
Okay.
So say everyone else gets about 2 weeks.
The Hogwarts seat of high learning. Well.
Yeah, sad.
I didn't do any of that. I didn't think I did my first bit of work till my third year. So.
It explains a lot.
Yeah. I was in the sort of Van Wilder-like education system of Scottish universities where you can kind of stay as long as you like. And it was amazing.
Excellent. So what
so
was
Van Wilder, which is
Van
for
Wilder.
Me basically a documentary.
We see Van Wilder 2.
Not that I was as cool
the
as
The Rise
Van
of Taj mm-hmm. was kind of set in my neck of the woods, but was utterly wrong on every possible level. So that would not be one of the best.
I haven't seen it. Is it worth watching?
No, it's terrible. I mean, it basically has some, you know, Oxbridge Academy type place, but they've got inexplicably American traditions, like essentially fraternities, and they've got some weird inter-house competition that doesn't make any sense. And they think you can recreate the Battle of Agincourt with paintballs, and it's all very upsetting from a sort of historical angle, and I didn't like it.
Is Taj, is he the one in Van Wilder who comes to an American university to learn the noble art of muff diving?
That is correct.
Right,
yeah.
And so he got a spin-off.
He did.
But don't watch it.
Well, I wouldn't rush out. That's,
okay.
that's all I'm saying. Yeah.
Not it's not in my list, that one, either.
No,
actually.
No.
It's shocking.
We should probably answer the question, really.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many to choose from. I dabbled with university, so I don't know if I'm 100% qualified to answer the question. I never graduated, but...
You had Freshers Week.
I had multiple Freshers fortnights.
Oh, my God.
But we won't get into that. I think keeping it modern... I mean, I've got things like The Graduate and... flatliners was wow. one. I mean, that's not a good time studying, but that's certainly an interesting time. Legally Blonde, etc., etc. Everybody wants some. I, as someone who went to school, college in the 80s, I feel, you know...
Were you born in the 80s?
I was born in the 80s.
Like 89 or something, right?
88.
80, right.
Yeah.
Okay, well.
Everybody wants some. I love it so much this year. And to me, that's one of the most fun times. I kind of felt a bit jealous that I wasn't playing baseball and one of the lads.
That is, I think, possibly the definitive Freshers' Week film. I feel like that is now the one to beat in terms of depiction of the first week of university. Phil is looking suspiciously at me like he doesn't agree.
This is my morning face.
Oh, well, I'm sorry.
Animal House, I was just wondering if that has a Freshers' Week in it. I can't remember.
I can't remember either. It always seemed like it was building up to the end of term more than the beginning.
It certainly has possibly my favourite scene in one of these movies, which is the courtroom scene where he somehow makes their fraternity gross misdemeanors into an attack on the very fabric of American society and leads everyone out of the courtroom in disgust, which I really enjoy. I don't know, there's plenty of serious ones, but it's always the kind of fratty ones that spring first to mind, don't they?
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
Like when you talk about this, you don't immediately think of Wonder Boys or The Graduate necessarily, even though there's a clue in the title.
But yeah, hasn't he left university though in The Graduate? Isn't that the point?
Isn't it his last summer holidays?
Yeah. Isn't he The Graduate? Like, I feel like the clue's in the
title. You think he's graduated?
I mean, I'll be honest, I'm now beginning to question myself, but I feel like he's graduated.
Would it confuse you further if I told you the working title was The Undergraduate?
Oh, that's confusing.
And they lost it because it was too syllabic. We should know the answer to that.
I have some suggestions. I would like to submit Starter for 10, which I think is really good
on my list.
On your sort of awkwardness at university and the fact that you maybe don't immediately become the super coolest person around.
No.
So good.
There's life imitating art in there, isn't there? Because Benedict Cumberbatch, the least cool person University Challenge.
Yeah, he is. But I remember loving him in that film and thinking and just being fascinated by him.
Sure.
So I feel like I was like ahead of the curve on that one. You know, everybody else just caught up.
He's brilliant in that.
He is brilliant. His jumpers are appalling. But I knew people in college who wore that jumper, basically. So it kind of rang true to me.
Sure.
I would also say, I mean, I would actually, again, say Legally Blonde. I think Legally Blonde actually reminded me more of my college years than Van Wilder did, despite being set further away. Pitch Perfect, I think, is good as well, about finding your people and finding your posse at university. And one I watched recently for the first time, and I know that's terrible and I should have seen it years ago, The Way We Were with Barbra Streisand and Robert Redford. I mean, he was at that point where, like, basically every outfit he wore, he'd come on screen and I'd say to my sister, my God, he shouldn't be allowed to wear that. That's ridiculous. Because he just looked ludicrously good in everything. So that was kind of distracting. But the college stuff was kind of interesting because she's the kind of fired up, passionate student union rep person. And he's the kind of jock type who she dismisses out of hand, but actually has a lot going on under the surface and is quite interesting, really. So that was very cool. I liked it.
Okay.
He's finished college and The Graduate. He has graduated.
He has.
Oh.
Ah. He is his last summer, right?
Don't I feel like a dummy? He's finished and he's also graduated. And he's graduated from a place called Williams College, which is a liberal arts college in Massachusetts. It's a real place.
Ah.
So there.
Strike that one then.
Another liberal arts college setting recently is Whit Stillman's Damsels in Distress, which has some funny bits as well, more from a female point of view.
I was going to say, not because it's brilliant, but just because that brought it to mind, the Josh Radnor one.
Liberal Arts.
Is that what
literally called Liberal Arts?
But that would be why it came to mind. But there were some good bits in that. I like the sort of judging people by their books thing, which is not necessarily the best way to judge someone, always.
One we can definitely all relate to, I guess, is The Social Network, you know.
Of course.
Yeah, I mean, we all made our billions first in college.
Yeah, I like to think of myself as a Napster type. But I mean, that's fantastic anyway. That has to be in there, but I don't think it's one that we can necessarily all relate to.
I was always doing complex formulas on Windows.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was always rowing.
Well, you do look like Andrew Garfield, so, you know.
Yeah.
It does
do
kind
I?
Of. Yeah.
Okay. It's like he's in the booth.
There you go.
It's a little bit.
But he's just, okay.
In that film especially, like, he's doing a full fill.
Really?
Yeah, it's really there.
Okay. Right. Fair enough. And 22 Jump Street.
Yeah.
22 Jump Street. You're not wrong.
Yeah.
I can't argue with that. I won't even try.
It's funny though, because in Van Wilder, nobody really points out how old he is all the time, do they? Mm-hmm. Whereas those two, like, they just walk in and everyone's like, you're so old.
You're so old. Couldn't be older.
Yeah.
Well, they do that in, I know it's not a college film, but Never Been Kissed as well, that people keep going to, are you sure you're a teenager?
Yeah.
And she's like, yeah, I'm a teenager. Uh-huh.
And David Arquette. Yeah, just been held back a few years.
What about, there's a college scene in a film that I don't know if you've seen it.
Okay.
It's called Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of Something. I can't remember.
I don't think that's
a thing. But there's
a
chase through a campus.
Oh, yes, through the library and everything.
And then there's a bit that's, they've just taken some stuff from Happy Days and they've just sort of reshot it.
What, with the shark?
With, like, people fighting.
Oh, yes.
No, the shark. Yeah, no, that, on a metaphorical level, the shark. But in a real level, the jocks and the whatever.
Yeah.
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 Does that ring any bells?
I mean, if I'd seen it, I'm sure it would, but I've never heard of that film.
Yeah.
The motorcycle going... I had a dream about the motorcycle going through into the library.
Yeah.
All the time, I really enjoyed that.
It was okay.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, it's a good little scene.
Yeah. Another question we got this week was good scenes in bad movies, which we may tackle another time, but I feel like that would be a good way to segue into that if we were to do that.
Darn, it would, because I've got a great answer to that question, which I can't think of right now, so we should definitely come back to that another week. I remember watching a bad movie a few weeks ago and thinking, oh, that's an amazing scene, though.
Sure.
Yes. We should definitely do that question another time.
Let's do it. Okay. But on that note, let's stop there. We seem to have, I think, provided a completely definitive answer to that question, or at least a useless series of ramblings, but something along those lines. Anyway, if you would like your question answered with the same gobsmacking intellectual rigor that we were taught at some of the best universities in the country, you can, of course, tweet us. We're at Empire Magazine and the hashtag is Empire Podcast. We are podcast@empireonline.com if you would like to email, or we're on Facebook at Empire Magazine. I think it's time for a guess before we move on. Here is a man whose very name describes a style of filmmaking, whose movies range from Oscar-nominated biopics to the two best Batman movies. Yes, I said it. Come at me. I don't care. To the wild, dark fairy tales for which he's best known. His latest film is Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children, a film based on a book inspired at least in part by his previous films. Ladies and gentlemen, Tim Burton.
Super delighted to be joined by Tim Burton on the Empire Podcast again. You came very kindly to talk to us about Big Eyes, and now you're back to talk about Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children, which is a title that I struggle to say.
Say that three times fast.
Can you do that?
No.
It's challenging. Did you have a shorthand for it instead?
Miss P.
Miss P. I, first of all, love the fact that you cameo in this film. Did you give
that was
your...
out of necessity, really.
Oh, really? What happened? Was there a story behind that?
Well, I shouldn't say this because I could get into trouble for it, but no, we I needed a few more shots and we were done shooting and we didn't have any permits or crew or film or people, so we just kind of snuck up to Blackpool and just did a couple of little shots. Yeah.
Okay. That is so
just on the sly, you know.
This is amazing. So this is like old school kind of out the back of a van filmmaking.
Oh, yeah.
On a big
yeah.
blockbuster.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Now,
yeah.
I was going to ask you about this a bit
got
later.
Got chased off the pier a few times. You know?
Did you? But I was going to ask you about this a bit later, but I think now's a good time. You have declared yourself in the past Blackpool Pleasure Beach's biggest fan, which is a really big statement.
I don't know if it's I'm the biggest one, but I do love it. And I don't know quite why I love it so much, but it's a bit disturbing, you know. If I really try to explore all the reasons, it's, you know, maybe take years of therapy for that one.
Well, we've got 20 minutes. you actually had the honor, and you followed in the footsteps of such, no pun intended, luminaries as Kermit the Frog, the Bee Gees, Les Dawson, and Terry Wogan in turning on the Blackpool Illuminations.
You know what? Sometimes in your life, you get these little moments. You know, I got my hands and feet in the Chinese theater in L.A., right? That was recent. But Lighting the Lights in Blackpool was another just like, you know, tick it off your box is like one of the great things to do. You know, it was just such a honor to do it, and I loved it. You know, I felt like the unofficial mayor of Blackpool.
Do you think now that you've confessed to having shot illegally in Blackpool, they're going to turn the lights off again?
No, I hope. Look, I didn't break any major laws. You know, it was just a little quick shot here and there. That was okay. I mean, you know.
Yeah. Well, look, I mean, hopefully, we should contextualize this in saying that the film obviously is set partly on the pier in Blackpool.
Yeah, a little bit. We shot a little bit there. You know, we had a lot of different locations. But that was just one that I don't know why. I just find those kind of places so sort of poetic and beautiful and haunting. And, you know, there's just something that's very, very, I don't know. I find it very sort of reflective when I go there. I just like walking along the pier, and it just sort of suits my mood in a way.
It's quite a specific. On the podcast, we get asked questions, and we haven't been asked this, but films that are shot on piers, like famous moments. You can't think of that many. Like the Brighton Rock has a famous one.
Yeah, I mean, there was one that I remember. It was called Night Tide with Dennis. It's a black and white film where he plays a sailor. And he meets like a mermaid and like on the old pleasure beach. That had a haunting quality. I haven't seen it in a while, but and that's why I used to always go to the Santa Monica Pier. And there was another one called Incredibly Strange Creatures Who Stopped Living and Became Mixed Up Zombies. I don't know if you've seen that one.
See,
if you have trouble
that
with Miss Peregrine title,
yes,
this one's even worse. That's shot on a pier. So there are some.
Going back to the sort of the casting process, we've got Samuel L. Jackson in this. You have not worked with him before, which seems weird. Have you ever come close?
No, but he's somebody I always wanted to work with, you know, just because he's like one of the few actors that I can think of who, if I hear he's in a movie, I just want to see him.
Yeah.
Because you know, I can just see him. If he's in 10 movies a year, I'll watch him because I just think he's just something about him. Such a strong, he's just such a strong, I don't know. And he's always, I just love him. You know, he's just got such a power and such a strength to him.
Yeah. Miss P, as I'm allowed to call it that.
Yeah.
Miss P, the obvious sort of touch points now, especially as you've got Jane Goldman scripting and she wrote one of the X-Men movies, is the X-Mansion, a bit of Harry Potter. But to me, there was a lot more of the sort of the universal monster stuff in this.
I mean, that's what I liked about what the way Ransom had constructed the novel. You know, I actually liked the book even before I read it, just looking through it, because based on the pictures, there's something that's quite sort of, you know, because I collect photographs myself, and when you look at a photograph, sometimes it's like it tells you a story, but then you're not quite sure the whole story of it. There's something that's quite haunting about them, poetic, creepy, weird, you know, and that was a vibe that I thought was very interesting about the book. It's almost like a weird, you know, children's horror, bedtime horror story kind of aspect to it. And, you know, Jane, who's done all that stuff, you know, we never thought of it as like, you know, X-Men kids, because the kids, they're not really powers, they're more afflictions, you know.
Yeah.
And it's not like they're like these powerful superheroes, they're just like basically like weird little kids, normal kids. And that's the thing that I liked about it, and I think Jane and everybody, you know, responded to in it.
Yeah, one of your kids is he spews bees from his face in a way that makes you think this movie might be like a gateway film to Candyman. I mean, it's kind of
yeah, no, I mean it is weird, you know. But the great thing is that they're all just kids. One guy just happens to have bees living inside of him, you know. One girl happens to have a mouth on the back of her neck, you know. One you know, but you know, they're basically kids, you know, which I found quite funny and weirdly real.
Do you have the Invisible Boy as well?
Yeah, which I wouldn't mind being.
is there a casting challenge? How do you go about casting an Invisible Boy? Is he sort of disqualified when he turns up and you can see him?
Yeah, no, it's like, you know, no, yeah, the poor boy, he had a blue thing, he had to wear a blue mask the whole time. It's like,
did he?
But the little twins had to wear masks. Everybody had some problem on this movie, do you know what I mean?
Do you as director kind of find a way of sharing their toils somehow? Or?
Well, I do try to like put a mask on just to see what it's like, do you know what I mean? Because I think it's helpful to sort of see what people are going through a little bit, you know, just to feel it out a little bit.
Can the, could the twins see anything through it?
We had to cut the eye holes a slit. Yeah, no, they, it was quite interesting because again, these kids, they'd never acted, they'd never done anything before, and they were real twins. But it's like off the set, you know, I'd go, hi, and they'd both go, hi, at the same time, or they'd see them eating lunch and they'd be sort of eating at the same time. It was weird, man. It's like, wow, method acting. They don't even know what method acting is, you know.
Were you tempted to buy them a pair of tricycles and set them loose?
They were, it was quite interesting. Everything the same.
There's a really beautiful scene in the middle of this film, which has one of the kids reanimating really super creepy creatures with tiny hearts, tiny organs, and a tiny brain, which is incredibly Harryhausen-esque, if I can make the obvious parallel.
Of course.
Of course it is. But was that actually, wasn't stop motion?
Yeah, that was
stop motion. It was stop motion, yes.
Yeah. I mean, we did that stop motion. I mean, I would do more stop motion in things, but it's just so time consuming. Mm. I mean, that was a sequence which was manageable to do in the time that we had. And it just felt appropriate. I mean, I'd do it anytime I could just because I love the medium, you know. It's something that's just, you know, it's tactile, and you know, Harryhausen was such an influence in terms of why I liked being in the movies, you know. So it's still a really strong medium, and you know, if I had time, I'd do more of it.
It was a beautiful, it's such a lovely, I wish there were more out there. I mean, Leica have obviously got, I don't know if you've seen Kubo yet, but you know, there's a few people that are still flying the flag for stop motion. Yeah, do you think, you know, after Frankenweenie, you have another stop motion movie in you?
Well, yeah, definitely. But you know, they have to be, you know, yes, definitely. Definitely. I mean, you know, Nightmare, Corpse Bride, Frank and Weenie, all stop motion. And I think if I were to do another anime, it would definitely be stop motion. Yes.
Wonderful. It's been an incredible year for animation, really. I mean,
yeah, well, for the last several years, I mean, it's been great, you know. I ever since this sort of, ever since I basically got out of animation, it's been going very well, you know.
Well, now's the time maybe to get back in. But it is sort of, it does tend to be the kind of the CG animations. I mean, Finding Dory's obviously top of the tree this year, which has come as a bit of a surprise.
But there's been some movie, they don't come to mind. But, you know, I remember several years ago I said, well, drawn animation is dead and stuff. But there's been great drawn animation films, great stop motion, you know, great computer. I mean, they're all valid. They're all great. It's just, it's nice when they're all still out there. Do you know what I mean? Instead of just like, because I remember, you know, when the computer first started to become, you know, the thing, they go, well, we're not going to do any more drawn movies. We're not going to do any stop motion movie. You know, they're trying to sort of get rid of everything else. So, but luckily it's all stayed and remains, you know, each one remains powerful.
There's a sequence in this that's Harryhausen-esque, inspired by Harry. I don't want to give away because it's third act.
Well,
skeletons. Which you've done before with the killers.
Well, yeah, no, I just, you know, look at everyone. We all have them, don't we? So
yeah, for sure.
We can all relate to a skeleton, or at least we should, because we all have them. But yeah, no, I mean, it was in the script, and I thought, well, of course, that sequence. You know, I remember going to the cinema saying it was one of the first secret things I ever remember about going to the movies. You know, it was just like so powerful. It was so strong. I had never seen, you know. So the point was, is like, and oftentimes, you know, I didn't go out of my way to do it, but they sort of, those kind of things that inspire you very much in your DNA, and they're very much a part of, you know, why you like making movies. So when I read it in the script, I thought, that'll be fun.
As someone who obviously made two Batman films and very nearly made Superman, I have to ask, have you seen Batman versus Superman Dawn of Justice?
No, I haven't. I can't. I think, you know, and I haven't seen the documentary based on the Superman thing for that.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, I just, it's that was such a painful experience. experience. Yes. You know, you ever work on something for like a year and then it gets, it's like, wow, you know? So no, I haven't. Not yet. Maybe on the plane on the way back, but the best way to watch that is that I'm not sure.
I guess that requires an element of therapy for you as well.
It'd be interesting
to see how different or if there are any similarities.
Well, I mean, everybody, like, it's always funny because it's like, you know, the Batman I did, everybody gets kind of like, oh, they sort of rag. It's like, oh, Michael Keaton, not a good Batman. And then every Batman I hear, it sounds like Michael Keaton. It's like, it's like, well, why, if you didn't like it so much, why do you sound like him, you know?
Yeah, no, that's a good point, actually. Yeah, that's fair enough. I have to ask you about Nick Cage, because you were close to doing that with him. Do you have a favorite memory of working with Nick Cage, at least in pre-production?
Well, no, we had good ideas, I thought, you know, we really did. I thought it was, you know, we were attempting to do what is being done, which is just explore those feelings, you know, what it's like to be like that, and what it's like to feel like that, and what it's like to be an alien on another planet, you know. I mean, this was all stuff that was, you know, we were really excited about.
Yeah. Did he go far down that route? Do you have any memories of...
Oh, yeah. Well, no, we just talked about it a lot, you know. We tried... We didn't get as far as doing real... You know, we did preliminary kind of costumey kind of things, which weren't really, you know, meant for, you know...
Yeah.
They weren't done, you know, just early. But that's as far as we got with anything.
Dumbo. Your Dumbo.
Don't know.
Beetlejuice.
Don't know.
Okay.
No, because of those other circumstances.
Yes.
That's why I just don't say, because, you know, I could say, yes, I'm doing this. I've got a 5-picture deal with, and it's like, well.
But assuming that the Jungle Book success this year has made Dumbo a more viable prospect.
But, you know, we'll see.
All right. Tim, thank you so much.
Thanks
for joining us again. Real pleasure.
Thank you. Nice to talk to you.
What a nice man. All right, time for some movie news now. The meat in the movie-making sandwich. What happened this week?
Hakuna Matata.
I mean,
it's a wonderful phrase. Phrase.
Oh, well, Phil doesn't know the word, so this piece of news could be quite helpful.
Fill me in.
The Lion King. It's having a, well, air quotes, live action remake.
I mean, yes, we have to put in those air quotes, don't we? Because, so this is Jon Favreau.
Yes.
Who just King made the again, air quotes, live action Jungle Book. Now, the live action Jungle Book did have a live action element. His name was Mowgli. Will this have any live action elements, do we think?
Someone did a funny tweet of a gif of the, like, take one on the Lion King, and it was just a lion mauling someone. But, I mean, I would imagine that the template is there already from the Jungle Book.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's different animals there.
Well, yeah obviously.
You know, different continent.
Flora and fauna.
Or is this the Jungle Book 2 colon the Lion King?
It's not going to be like the original Jungle Book, which they then turned into Robin Hood.
That's true, yeah, where they reuse the animals.
Where they reuse the animals, where they're just going to stick, like, fur on Baloo.
Yeah, he's already furry.
Different sort of fur.
Right,
golden
got you.
Fur,
yeah, got you,
and
got
a
you.
Big tail, and say, go on then, line it up,
but
bitch.
You're right, though, like, all of the technology is there. If he was ready to go and do The Jungle Book 2, then, which I'm, you know, assuming now, there is absolutely no way that he can, unless he has two kind of separate sound stages and, you know.
Well, I mean, how much would need to be done on soundstage in this case? I don't know. I mean, I know they had actors come in and sort of contribute, certainly voices, to the Jungle Book. I don't know how much mocap there was for them. I don't think there was a huge amount. So that was pretty much NPC starting their stuff.
So clever.
So I genuinely don't see how there can be really any live action elements to this, unless they go to Africa and essentially shoot plates, you know.
I think that's likely, isn't it? I mean, the environments are going to be different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very much so.
More, obviously, savanna and maybe some mountains.
Sure.
Some desert, maybe. And I don't know. Good question. Because you're right that you take the human element out of the story. What have you got?
Yeah.
You don't have a lot that's naturally soundstagey.
It is just Bambi with teeth. I mean, I've always been a little bit of a Lion King skeptic. I know everybody loves it. And it's not that I don't like it. I just, like, out of those Disney, out of that era of Disney renaissance, it's my least favourite.
Oh, wow. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. But you know, I mean, Jungle Book was great, really loved it. Lion King is obviously a hugely popular story. I can see why you'd want to revisit it. I don't understand how this is fundamentally a different thing. But perhaps that will all become clear because Jon Favreau, we like him a lot and we've got to hope for the best.
It's an interesting idea.
Yeah.
I mean, it's an interesting idea that, you know, you had what then was a traditional animation, and that we've talked about the Jungle Book redefining what animation means now.
Yeah.
As much as you want to dress it up as a live action film, it is 99% an animation. And you know, it'd be an interesting compare and contrast exercise. I guess as far as Disney is concerned, this is right in the sweet spot, because obviously the Lion King film is well loved, but the musical has kept the brand quote unquote top of mind for a long time now.
Yeah.
I love this stuff. You know, people, it's passed on from generation to generation. Everyone knows the words to the song.
Well,
apart from me. And Elton John's still alive. So, you know, there's many things that can come together on this one and make it a big hit. I'm sure it will be.
I wonder what they'll do with the songs, because in Jungle Book, obviously, they played around with it, but it wasn't relying on that, which arguably the original animation did. This has a lot more behind it, as Phil said, the musical. So are people going to be expecting all the songs? I don't know. This is going to be... I'm really, really intrigued by it.
Do you think they're going to get somebody in to rewrite the songs?
Don't even.
Like they did for The Little Mermaid. I mean, for Little Mermaid, they brought in Lin-Manuel Miranda to work on it. So, you know.
Good.
Everyone take a shot.
It's the circle, in many ways, of life.
It is.
What else would you say about that?
I would say...
Do you know any other ones?
What else would I say?
Give
me something else.
I mean,
what?
This is just very enjoyable seeing you not know.
Cheers.
Would you say it rules us all, Phil?
Possibly. I might say that. Is that a trick? Is that actually a song?
That's actually a lyric.
He's feeling both despair and hope at this.
I'm going to go away and learn all of the songs, because this is going to run, and I might make
and next week you do an intro.
I might come back with more.
Circle of Life.
Indeed.
Hot Wheels.
Yes, segue.
Okay. That wasn't. Hot Wheels, tell me more.
Justin Lin.
This is crazy.
Is in talks to make a Hot Wheels movie. Do people know what Hot Wheels are?
Are those the tiny, tiny cars?
In my head right now.
Are they the tiny, tiny cars?
Hold on, there's an advert.
Yeah, when we were growing up, we used to watch like Power Rangers on telly, in between, they'd always be like, Hot Wheels.
You forget, Phil's much older. He watched Bill and Ben.
That's so mean.
I'm sorry.
It's true, though. Okay.
I think I have some, maybe.
Hot Wheels. Were they the tiny ones?
Little metal, but like tiny. Matchbox, but Hot Wheels.
They did like monster trucks, but they were still mini.
But they were still mini ones.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
But they weren't the tiny, tiny, tiny ones, were they? Am I thinking of...
Micro machines.
Those are micro machines. Okay, that's what I was getting.
Hot Wheels is American toy.
Okay.
About, this will be useful for listeners, so big.
Right, he's holding his fingers about 3 inches apart.
Okay,
two and a half maybe.
So, and also... I guess similar to Matchbox cars.
Okay.
So we could see maybe a Mike Lee Matchbox movie as a rival at the same time.
I mean, Justin Lin has some form with fast cars.
Yeah.
So
Mike Lee actually likes cars too.
Right.
Anyway, I'm getting sidetracked. Mike Lee's not making a movie about Matchbox cars. Justin Lin does have that previous, doesn't he?
Yeah.
The Fast franchise.
Mm-hmm.
So do we know anything about what this story would be, or what would be happening with the Hot Wheels?
I'll be honest with you. Our news coverage of this was somewhat sidetracked by punning. We've sort of prioritised punning over actual hard news
on this
one.
So unlike us.
Which is, but it is something that's been kind of at the workshop since 2003. McGee was going to make it, and then Joel Silver at Warner's took over the deal, but I mean, it's been a long time in the making, so they presumably have witnessed the gigantic success of the Fast franchise and thought, you know, let's get the director of one of those movies and have a go. But no, in terms of like actual detail information on the project, there isn't a lot out there at the moment, so it's kind of a watch this parking space.
This tiny parking space.
Tiny.
Do you think they'll be tinier? Do you think they'll be like normal sized cars?
I'd be good if they were tiny.
Yeah, I think it'd be more fun.
But like in a real world environment.
Yeah.
So like ant car.
Kind of like Honey, I Shrunk the Car.
Crossover with the Borrowers.
That might be fun.
Who knows?
Who indeed?
With the, it seems like more and more year on year at the moment, you get these projects and you can't even imagine what they're going to do with it. And sometimes they turn out to have a really clever idea, and sometimes, in the case of, say, Monster Trucks, it seems like they don't necessarily. So we shall see.
Yeah, fingers crossed. All right. Any other news?
So Emma Thompson and Mindy Kaling, in a duo we probably never expected to see, they are pairing up for, well, currently untitled new movie, but it's set in the world of late night talk shows.
Interesting.
It's interesting because the first thing you said to me was, wait a minute, there are no female late night talk show hosts.
Yeah, right? There's more men called John.
There are a lot of men. That's like a prerequisite. You have to be called John. Or
they've got a quota for men called John. It's affirmative action for men called John.
Yeah. James was close enough, right? There's no studio attached, and this is very, very thin on the ground in regards of actual information. But Scott Rudin's going to be producing it, and the plot's going to find Thompson as a veteran chat host, and she's in danger of losing her long-running series. So unfortunately, this just happens to coincide with her hiring her first female writer in the show's history. So it's a bad time for women, basically, in this film. That sounds really interesting, and I'm guessing that's going to be quite a fierce bidding war with those two involved.
I would imagine. I mean, Emma Thompson was fantastic in Bridget Jones's Baby,
she?
And I think her polish on the script really added something to it. Mindy Kaling, of course, phenomenal as a writer and as a star. I think they could be really interesting together.
Yeah, I wonder if they're going to be, you know, sort of on scripting duties in any way. So they haven't really got anything else on it, but that's one to look out for sure.
Definitely. Staying in comedy news, I know Chris would want us to mention in his absence that MacGruber 2 is at the writing stage.
No.
Yes. Will Forte and Jorma Taccone are writing MacGruber 2. I don't know if that means it has a green light or if they're just sort of
bored
working on it, but you know, they've just got a bit of time over lunch, so they thought they'd whack out
busy,
a script.
Right?
Yeah.
They have, because they're so busy.
What? Come on, that's not true.
It didn't make a huge amount at the box office, obviously, but it was pretty successful on DVD and cable, so it's not unthinkable that, you know, they could make a fairly low budget kind of sequel.
He's the super cult character, really.
Yeah.
Let's be honest.
And I think MacGyver's coming back to TV, isn't it? So it might be the right time for a new MacGruber.
MacGruber.
I want to see that one.
I would like to see the MacGruber movie.
Let me add one more.
Yes, please.
David Mamet.
Yes.
The bone dry, pitch black screenwriter, playwright, and director, has taken over the adaptation of his own play, Speed the Plough, this week. And which is interesting because, I mean, he's always, I think, probably always going to be associated with something that he didn't direct.
Glengarry Glen Ross.
But he has done some really, really highly watchable movies of his own material.
He has a pass for life with me for Stay in Maine, which I adore.
I know you love that film.
Oh, I love it.
It is a very, very good film. And this is another one that's got a Hollywood angle. It's not quite as affectionate, I don't think.
No.
As that one. This is a much darker kind of look at the competitiveness and ego that drives the Hollywood machine. Probably quite similar to Emma's story, the Emma Thompson one, in some ways. You know, it's that inside track on how projects, you know, the stakes on bringing projects together. It was going to be someone else. It was going to be a guy called Michael Polish, but now it is going to be Mamet himself. And if you've seen, obviously, Stay in Maine, Spanish Prisoner, Heist,
Winslow Boy,
you know, he knows what he's doing.
Yeah.
On that side of the camera, and something to, I think, look out for and potentially be excited by.
Yeah, definitely. If anyone hasn't read his book Bambi versus Godzilla about movie making, that's also definitely worth a look. That's a sort of non-fiction look at how movies get made, and it's interesting.
Now, you know how, like, I can be the king of the segue because I did all that in the art of the segue.
Stunning.
Right, watch
segue
this. This is like the walk of segues.
Okay, I'm just going to take notes.
Act.
I'm going to take notes.
All right, yeah, prepare yourself for this. So, Mute, Duncan Jones's movie, right? He's been planning it for a long time. Alexander Skarsgård is in it, alongside Paul Rudd. Now, I have read in an interview that Alexander Skarsgård, and this is I've read this today on the way here,
fresh off the press,
that this is going to be a Netflix movie.
Oh,
now I have not seen or found corroboration of that. I've not even had a chance. I literally just found it on the way here, as I say. So we are going to ask Alexander Skarsgård in this very podcast coming up if that's true.
Okay, and you're actually going to know the answer before we do, because we're recording this entire podcast and then doing the interview with Alexander Skarsgård. Then we're going to splice it in.
Oh my word!
The podcast.
It's me. I'm going to be the one doing it.
Oh my god!
So I feel like a puppet master in charge of time.
It's like in Interstellar, where they go back in time, and I come through the other dimension.
You're Matthew
McConaughey.
And push
a book off a shelf, but that book will actually be Alexander Skarsgård.
Wow!
Oh my god! I can't believe you're pushing Alexander Skarsgård off a shelf.
I know, right?
How can you risk that perfect figure?
I think he's pretty robust, though, isn't he?
He's very tall. I don't know how high this bookshelf is going to have to be to actually hurt him, so I think we're okay.
Well, now, that is a perfect segue, though, of course, because our next guest, or I should say guests, are here to talk about John Michael McDonagh's latest film, The War on Everyone. It follows up The Guard and Calvary, both of which we adore, and this one stars Alexander Skarsgård, the aforementioned, and Michael Peña, the always mentioned because he's great, and they're both here, or will be here in a second, but will have been here, to talk about it. So enjoy.
Welcome to the Empire Podcast. Alexander Skarsgård and Michael Peña.
Thanks, sir.
Thank you. Hello, 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 hello.
How is that?
Hello, 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 hello.
Michael, you have a beautiful voice for radio.
Thanks, man.
Do you need to do like warm up exercises before you do broadcast?
Well, I was doing them earlier.
I kind of prefer. I think this is sexier than when you warm up. When this is just kind of straight out of bed.
Oh, you mean
morning raspy, sexy?
Yeah. Everyone sounds like Barry White.
Yeah. Good morning. This is Michael Peña.
How's it going, everybody? Listen, we got Alexander Skarsgård here from the new movie Tarzan, which was a big hit. From now, he's got War on Everyone.
I did that a couple of weeks ago in the States.
Did you really?
And I was talking to the guy before we went on air, and it was like just this really nice, normal conversation.
Oh,
and
then, I know what you're getting.
The red light went on. It's like, good morning. We're in the studio with Alexander Skarsgård. Alexander. So good to have you here, man. How are you?
Yeah, and it's amazing.
Like, you were really nice and normal 5 minutes ago, dude, and now you're on like drugs. Yeah. And I don't know what happened.
And especially in America, I do a lot of Spanish press, so I go to Miami, and imagine the Spanish dudes. They're like, you know, that you get somebody who's got kind of a mousy voice, and they do the same thing. Hola! I'm always like, are we supposed to match that energy?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I kind of tend to go in the other direction to kind of balance it. So I'm like, yeah, it's really, really nice.
Oh, you're like, you start listening to The Cure and start
kinda,
being very solid. Yeah.
But why is that? Is that because it's like morning radio and they
want to pump people up?
Yeah, they want to make sure that people wake up. Is that what it is? Is that why they scream?
So
they do this like high pitched thing? And
yeah, I think that
they're just very exaggerated.
Yeah, I mean, like, I used to work at a bank and that never pumped me up. It's not like it's.
Did you talk like that when you were a teller?
No, I mean, like.
How much money would you want to put in?
Yeah.
It's like deposit it is.
Yeah, like liquid liquid caffeine. I mean, vocal caffeine.
Yeah.
Hey, what is it? Good morning, Vietnam.
It is. It's Adrian Cronauer, isn't it?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Welcome to WGCR. Morning, International.
I always like these guys. It's like, welcome to WGCR, where we play the hits. It's 107.5 right now. We got no.
That's more like NPR voice.
No, that's no. In Chicago, okay. It's like, up next, we got some hot jazz for you.
We're probably a bit more like that. I don't know if you remember
hot jazz.
Salty hot jazz.
We're more of the salty hot jazz in the Empire podcast. I don't know if you remember Midnight Caller, the TV show with Jack Killian.
I don't.
Very.
Yeah, I remember that.
Do you remember it?
Yeah, I remember.
All right. Well, anyway, that's kind of more our thing, I guess.
Well, after that intro, I have to say that you guys.
Yeah.
Just so the listeners know, you sound exactly like you did 5 minutes ago before we went on.
Yeah, no,
air.
That's so really appreciated.
If anything, we go the other way. We're kind of more sort of energized and exuberant
exactly.
And then the thing starts and we're like, right,
Yeah.
Michael.
You guys are amazing off air.
Alex, right?
Alex.
You guys are in a film called War on Everybody.
Yeah. War on Everyone.
Yeah. War on Everyone.
But John Michael McDonagh.
Yeah.
That's it. Got
bad cop, worst cop is the tagline. Which one of you is the bad cop? Which one of you is the worst cop?
We got that question yesterday.
We seesaw a little bit.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's difficult to say. I don't know. We're kind of, I don't know.
I
start out really bad,
cop.
And then you outbat me, and then I outbat you, and then it goes deeper and deeper into the darkness, kind of.
Like, I think I set up a lot of stuff, and then
I ruin
you
it.
You go through it. You go through with it.
Yeah, Mike is more the brains of the operation.
By the way, I love the way that McDonough sets it up, and he's like, "I'll hit your car." And you're like, "Again?"
Is there any, can I still drive it? We should take my car.
You play Bob Bellano, yeah. Michael. You're a bad cop. You're actually quite a bad dad as well in this movie, in some ways.
Well, that's just your opinion, man.
Am I being judgy?
No, not at all.
I don't know. I mean, like, okay, it's a tough love dad, right?
He's a tough love dad.
And you overchlorinate the pool too, which is two of the sort of the worst sins in parenthood.
Yeah.
I've seen a tweet that you did quite recently about what you said. My son asked me where babies come from. I told him to ask his mom. She told him to ask me. This has been happening for 5 years now. Tell me he's not like in his late teens.
Yeah. No, he's 14 right now and minus 6.
All right.
No, he's 8
okay.
right now.
So
but you know what? They go to school and they're like, "So dad, where's the pussy?" I'm like, "Oh man. Dude, let's not do this right now, man. I'm drinking my coffee, man. I just woke up." "So I put this my dick in the pussy?"
No.
And I was like, "Oh man, dude, you're 6, man. Shit. Where did you hear this from?" "Well," I'm like, "Please, not my laptop." No, but it's like, it's when it's so, dude, I'm like, literally, I'm sweating. And I'm like, "My wife is going to kill me, dude." And then I'm like,
she just quietly walk out of the room and leaves you to do it.
No, but she just can confront this kind of thing much easier than I can. But still, when your 6-year-old kid comes up to you, he's like, "Dad." And you're like, what do you want, you little sunshine? Do you want to learn about water, whales? Where's the pussy?
Now, luckily, obviously, in a McDonough film, you can be as crass as you want. Yeah. That's all good. How was it kind of getting that script and knowing that you were going to do this film with him?
Well, it was a breath of fresh air, don't you think? Like, you just got through doing Tarzan.
Yeah.
How long did you shoot that for, by the way?
7.5 years.
Jeez.
Wow.
No, it was with the prep. It was all in all about 9 months, and it was towards the tail end of the shoot. We shot it here in London, actually, and it was up in Watford. Obviously, when you need jungle, you go to Watford. So Warner Brothers Estate, they have a studio up there, so we shot up there, and it was an incredible experience. Very, very intense, physically, mentally, and everything. And Tarzan is obviously kind of a heroic character, so it was definitely quite refreshing when I was sent this script. And you know, Terry is definitely not Tarzan. He's you know, drunk throughout the movie, and his moral compass is completely off. You know, it was just so out there, and I haven't done a comedy in many years. So I was really excited about it.
Yeah.
So and also, obviously, a big fan of John Michael McDonough. So I thought The Guard and Calvary were great, great movies.
Yeah, for me, it started backwards because I didn't watch those movies, and I had to do research. Just because I read it, and I was like, this is an amazing script. I don't know why it's so amazing. I want to see if he's able to pull it off. And his movies are even better than his scripts. Mm. So I was like, oh, I'm totally in. But it's got a very interesting sense of humor. It's I think it's very European, which I really like. It's not like you know, the jokes that we were doing about the pussy.
Yeah,
crass.
You guys clearly hate each other. Was it tough working together? Had you met before? Because you both did Eastbound and Down, but you weren't presumably in the same episode.
No. I only saw him once, and that was at Coachella, and you were with some paparazzi.
You saw me there?
Yeah.
When I went out with the cops and everything?
No. It was the paparazzi, and the paparazzi were being, I don't know how it is here, but they can be like just complete assholes in America. Like, there's, for some reason, they can do this.
Like, where this is radio, so you have to explain where you're.
Yeah. That's can, great radio.
Right up.
They can do right like this.
Extreme close-up.
Yeah. Extreme, yeah.
Snapping.
No, they can literally, right, they can literally snap. I totally forgot that this isn't filmed at all. No, but they can put the camera
for the
in your face.
Mike was just rolling around on the floor doing this whole thing.
I was doing the worm. I was doing the worm, and I was like, "You motherfucker." No, but they can do it in your face, and they just fucking kept hounding you, man.
And they also kind of, if, especially when there's a group of them, they like to provoke you because it's way more fun if they get a reaction out of you, the confrontation, than you just walking across the lawn or something. So sometimes they're intentionally in your face.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Being really rude and you know, obnoxious to kind of.
But especially at Coachella, you think that they would just lay off. at a music festival.
So did you see Alex in peril with the paparazzi and then wade in and kind of help him out?
Well, the dude is 6'4", you know right. what I mean? Like, yeah. I'm 5'9". So yeah, there's not going to be like, I got you, Alex. You know what I mean?
Stranger.
I'm an actor, too.
We always got each other's back.
Yeah. Screen Actors Guild. Yeah. Film Actors Guild, yeah. dude.
Sack for life, motherfucker. Yeah.
Where's your card, bitch?
Yeah. You mess with one actor, you mess with all of us.
Oh, yeah. Okay, guys?
Yeah. And you've obviously played a cop before.
Yeah.
Compared to working with David Ayer, what was it like just to be able to completely let your hair down and not give, you know, two flying whatever's about yeah. how you guys acted in this film?
Well, this was, this is completely different. I actually did no research at all for this movie. Because I'm thinking, like, every time I saw something that's like The French Connection or anything like that, you know what I mean? It just gave me no ideas. And
yeah.
and it was like, this is, John Michael McDonough has his own tone and his own kind of way of being. So I'm like, it didn't prepare me at all, you know, the other movies. Instead, I just kept reading and watching his movies. But it was, I mean, there's sometimes where, like, I would read it at night, you know, the stuff that we were doing the following day. I was like, I can't believe we're doing this. What did I sign up for? You know?
Anything
and
in particular?
And just, like, little stuff. Like, I guess when you read it, you know what I mean? Like, you think, like, oh, that's cool. That's a cool bit. That's a cool gag. That's a cool gag. And then you think, you're like, wait a minute. I'm going to shove a midget in water and take off his hairpiece. I was like, all right, I want to see how this plays out. And then some of this stuff is funnier than you thought, than I thought, like chasing a mime, you know?
So good.
And then he's like, I wonder if they, like, if you hit them, like, are they going to make any sound?
Yeah.
And then hit him. Well, now you know, motherfucker.
But I did a morning show yesterday, and they tried to pull a scene from the movie to show, and they couldn't. They couldn't find a single scene that wasn't offensive. So they showed like 5 seconds of that like clip with the mime before we hit him. It's like, oh, and here's a clip from the movie. Like, sorry, yeah, we couldn't find anything.
They show stills.
Yeah.
Stills
they
from the movie.
Find 5 seconds of a 1-hour and 40-minute long movie that wasn't offensive.
It really is war on everyone, because everyone, like, gets shit on. Everyone. Mexican, Latin, you know, white peoples, they get, you know, they get it too.
Irish.
Irish.
Mm-hmm. Irish. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, everyone. It's war on everyone.
Yes.
There's a great set piece in the middle where you guys ram raid a strip club. It needs no explanation, really. And then there's a foot chase. I interviewed John Michael McDonough, and he mentioned that there's a bit where Bob, your character, pulls out his badge
yeah.
with the police, but he doesn't have it because he's too kind of fucked up to remember to bring it with him. Now, he said that I don't know if you want to deny this or not, but he said that you guys were so hungover that morning that you actually had forgotten your badge to bring it with you on set.
No, actually, because that's the prop master's job.
Well, he was also hungover.
I didn't drink I didn't drink during the week while I shot this film. Maybe he was hungover.
I was hungover that day.
No, it was. Oh yeah, you were.
Yeah,
yeah.
When I was sitting at the bar with like, hey motherfucker, just give us the actress.
Oh, you were.
Yeah,
I thought that was a choice.
No, I make no choices at all in my acting. It's all no. Like...
So we did a couple takes with it, right? And yeah. then or rehearsed with it, and then I gave it to the prop master for some reason. Okay. I forgot. I think he was going to clean it up or something. And then I didn't have it, and I was like, Bob Lana. And that's where that came about.
Yeah.
But I only did that once. And then from then on, we kept it. But you just got to roll with the punches.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I'm glad he didn't cut. Oh, no, yeah. He did. I think he did cut.
When you didn't have it?
But it's in the movie.
Plus,
but it's a better story if you tell journalists that you went out the night before, you brought your badge to the club in Albuquerque, got yeah. shit-faced, like woke up on the sidewalk without the badge, went to work, still drunk.
Oh, yeah, maybe...
Like, oh,
maybe
I don't have my prop, oh, fuck it, I'll just, like, hold up my hand.
Oh, yeah, maybe he meant the character?
No.
No,
you, as
no,
a, he was, no, like, oh, Michael went out the night before.
Oh, because that's somebody like, else's job.
As a,
you know what, but I was all cracked out on cocaine and yeah. methamphetamines. And
take two of this story.
All the, I was, like, on the pills.
Yeah, this is the
I did all the pills, crack rock, and then I was like, oh, shit, I forgot my... whatever that is.
Yeah.
The thing.
That's a better story.
It's a much better story.
Thanks, bro.
You guys both got very exciting, cool projects coming up. Mute with Duncan Jones has been something that's been kind of in the making
you
for a long
moon,
time.
Right?
Yeah.
Did Moon.
And yeah. He actually wrote
Source Code.
Yeah. He wrote Mute before Moon.
Yeah.
So it's something, his little baby that he's been nursing for like 13 years.
Did I read that it's going to be a Netflix movie?
Yeah.
So it's going to screen on Netflix exclusively?
Yeah.
Wow, okay.
Yeah.
So it's not going to be in theaters at all?
Well, I think they'll do what they did on, was it Beast of No Nation? Like where they do a theatrical release, simultaneously as a Netflix release.
No cool. Shit.
Yeah.
But you're actually part of the Moon universe in this movie.
Yeah.
How? Do you know how? How it ties in?
Well, it is a futuristic movie. It takes place in Berlin 30 years in the future.
I thought you were going to say Brooklyn.
It takes place in Brooklyn 30 years in the future. So it's about a guy who was in an accident as a kid. He's ex-Amish. So it takes place 30 years in the future, but he lives in a very monastic life. He doesn't have a cell phone or anything like that. So he left the community, but still kind of follows the rules. And his girlfriend goes missing in the beginning of the movie. And it's about kind of him trying to figure out what happened to her. So he runs through the streets of this dystopian Berlin. Kind of, it's a bit Blade Runner vibe.
Yeah.
I just got back from Dublin. I met up with Duncan and he showed me all the renderings and the visuals of it. It looks, I'm very, very excited about it.
Is there a character from Moon in it or?
Maybe.
Yeah. Okay.
Damn, little tease.
Yeah, guess who? There aren't that many
Sam Rockwell.
Maybe, yeah, there might be. It's the same universe.
Yeah. Were you a Chips fan as a kid, Alex?
Chips?
Yeah, did you have Chips in the motorcycle?
Like fish and chips.
The cops.
California Highway.
I was Chips
as in
the
French
movie that Michael just said. Nice segue.
Yeah,
I was a massive fan. I'm really excited about Mike's.
I actually thought because we were
chips.
In England that he was saying, like, do you like chips? And I was
like,
of course
like
I love chips.
No, Chips the movie.
Yeah, because we had a conversation about this yesterday about chips being French fries. Right?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Which doesn't make any sense.
Or freedom fries, as we call them.
Freedom fries. But why two words? I mean, we definitely complicate the language for some reason. Instead of like, you know, we have trash can as opposed to a bin.
Yeah.
It's just a bin. That's where you throw things away.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Trunk and boot. And
yeah. Car park. No, we're going to call it a parking lot.
Yeah.
You know, we just add more syllables. Yeah, we even shorten America to America. So chips. You liked it? You did you grow up with it or did you watch it at all?
Yeah.
Yeah, thanks, man.
I loved that show?
Yeah.
Movie?
Yeah, that show.
I love that show.
Yeah.
Really did.
Yeah.
So
what was your favorite character?
Oh, I loved Thomas.
Oh yeah.
You know? I think it's Thomas. Yeah.
And probably the third episode, the guest star.
Yeah.
He was really good.
He had something. I don't know what it was, something just really strong, really kind of just a strong presence, I guess.
Yeah, well he killed himself, right?
I don't know. Yeah. No, I was just, I think like the first couple of seasons were amazing. I thought it was groundbreaking. It was fun. It was irreverent. It was out there.
There was only one season.
Yeah. And that, I mean, yeah, and that was a really
strong season. But it was so impactful that you thought it was like, whoa, this is like two seasons.
Yeah. But yeah. And then I'm talking about all the spinoffs because everyone would try to copy that. And then it started going down. So,
right.
Tell us a little bit about your movie, Mike. Chips. I think people are really, really excited about this.
We were like, are we going to
call the Chips fans out there?
Are we going to call it Chaps or Chips? We didn't know. We went with Chips.
I think that was an excellent choice.
Yeah. Yeah.
Are we guaranteed to hear the theme music? Which?
Oh, that's so good.
Do you want to do it?
Name that tune.
Benny.
You're using the Benny Hill music in Chips.
It's an odd choice, but it's quite interesting.
We would like happily let you guys take over the podcast almost on a permanent basis if you're not busy.
Well, Michael does have a beautiful radio voice,
doesn't
he?
Yeah.
And a radio face.
And you can do this sort of morning energized morning voice as well to get things started. We've got to wrap. Unfortunately, time is up. Last question. My Little Pony.
Did you watch that?
Duh.
Yeah. What was your favorite character?
I loved Tinkletoe.
That's actually
the blue, the one with the blue mane and and stars on the butt.
Oh yeah, oh yeah.
Who doesn't love a bone with stars on the butt?
You know what I mean?
That, yeah, like, I know what you mean.
It's making me think that you're like, you probably know about this from some like rave when you were 17 in Sweden. You know, some girl that you used to date or whatever. You know a lot about more than I do. Yeah, but now that I have a kid, I'm doing a bunch of I'm doing like anything just to be the cool dad. So I like Ant-Man and voiceover and stuff like that. You know, any kids things.
Can you wrap this up in your My Little Pony voice for us?
Why are we talking about My Little Pony?
He's in it. He's in it.
Are you in it?
Thank you, everyone, for coming. This was Michael Pena. This is Alexander Skarsgård. We're saying bye to everyone.
Have a lovely day out there.
Yeah.
Well, they will have been lovely. So that will have been great, I hope. Now, War and Everyone isn't out until next week, so we're not reviewing that today. But we do have many reviews to get through. There are about 70 bajillion films out this week, a little bit above average, so we're going to race through them. We're going to start with the aforementioned Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children, the first film to be named after an orphanage, I believe, since The Orphanage. So there you go, a little factoid for you. What can you tell me about this?
That is the most incredible piece of random trivia that you have yet no evidence
it's probably
for
wrong.
It's not even, yeah, who knows. Well, yeah, like you say, it's Tim Burton adapting someone who is in his own way kind of adapted Tim Burton. So it is a really kind of neat marriage of director and material. Maybe too neat in a way. It just sort of, I don't think Tim Burton needs much encouragement to go down the Burton-y sort of wormhole. I'm glad he made this film rather than Through the Looking Glass, for instance, which was, I guess, a possibility for him, because it does stretch him in some interesting new directions. It's funny to see a Tim Burton film, for instance, start in Florida, you know, in the sunshine on a beach. It's just like, whoa, you'd think all of his characters would kind of melt. But to set it up briefly, Asa Butterfield is he has a variable relationship with his parents, but a very close relationship with his grandfather, Terence Stamp. And it transpires that Terence Stamp has passed. The book itself is inspired by a collection of kind of old sepia photographs from around the world. So it has that real spirit of discovery and adventure. And Asa Butterfield's character has had that sort of inculcated by his grandfather, who has there's a dark side to it, basically. And we soon find out that that involves a variety of monsters, should we say, invisible monsters that are kind of wrangled by Samuel L. Jackson. And the epicenter of the story is Miss Peregrine's home itself, which is on a Welsh sort of island. And Asa travels there basically in the event of his grandfather's demise to find out more. And you know, without getting into too much of the plot nitty gritty, partly because I don't want to ruin it and partly because I don't really understand it, there's wormholes, there's timey-wimey business, it's sort of set in 1942, I think, or three, there's or maybe 1944, I don't know, somewhere in the war. There's a Luftwaffe attack which threatens to destroy, which does destroy Miss Peregrine's home, but Miss Peregrine herself, Evergreen, has a device which kind of resets the clock.
She's got a time turner.
It is kind of Through the Looking Glass a bit.
Yeah.
Anyway, she's got a time turner. It's complicated in a way that I don't think Tim Burton's really that interested in. It's just that's the plot. And Evergreen steals the show, as you'd expect. She's perfect. Like, her and Tim Burton seem like a marriage sort of made in kooky heaven.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you need somebody like that, don't you? Because he doesn't have Johnny Depp or Helena Bonham Carter.
No, it's true.
So, I don't know where to look, really. So
I know, it's weird. I mean, this, I guess, would have been a Helena Bonham Carter role, you know, maybe a few years back. I'm not sure if, you know, those two are going to continue sort of working closely together. But Evergreen does seem to have formed a tight sort of working relationship with him. And she's really good in this. And it kind of needs someone of her easy eccentricity. Because the eccentricity can often feel a bit forced in recent Tim Burton films. And with her, it's not forced. She's there chewing on a pipe with an incredible sort of, what would you call the airwave hairstyle, just living and breathing this world. And while she's on screen, you can't not appreciate it. The other thing I really loved about it was it's got some Harryhausen references. Okay. Tim Burton's obviously always been a big Harryhausen-ista, and has homaged him before. We talked about it in the interview. he did it with one of his killers music videos. He got the skeletons, and the skeletons sort of resurface in this one, and there's a really lovely bit of stop motion animation right in the middle of it, which is almost worth the admission fee alone, I would say. So there's plenty of things to like in it. It's probably more story driven than we're used to seeing from Burton in recent years. He seems to have eschewed story a lot of the time in favour of just a sort of selection of crazy world building exercises. This one's more narrative driven, perhaps a bit too much, I would say.
Right.
But, you know, still plenty to enjoy. If you're a fan of Burton, we've given it 3 stars.
All right, which is a recommendation.
That's a recommendation. Absolutely, absolutely a recommendation. So get along to see it. And I think, you know, the stop motion, it makes me want to see another Tim Burton stop motion animation.
All right.
Possibly one about the current US election, because I think that's tailor-made for the treatment.
Would watch.
The Nightmare Before Christmas.
Please say it won't be called that. Right, okay, so that's 3 stars from Miss Peregrine, which is a recommendation. Next up, we have Peter Berg's tribute to the men who died in the devastating oil rig disaster that poisoned the Gulf of Mexico. Mark Wahlberg leads the cast alongside Kurt Russell of a true life-based story about heroism in extremely difficult circumstances. Emma, what did you make of this?
So Deepwater Horizon is, as most of you know, about the terrible, terrible events that happened in the Gulf of Mexico in 2010 when the Deepwater Horizon, which is the name of the oil rig, it completely exploded and the whole thing just came down, killing, well, I don't want to say how many people, but it killed a lot of people. Peter Berg, kind of not fresh off of Lone Survivor, but post Lone Survivor, has taken another quite sensitive look at another true life disaster, and I think for the most part it's paid off really, really well. It doesn't feel exploitative, and I think it's a genuinely really heartfelt tribute to the people that lost their lives during this. So you've got Mark Wahlberg, who's playing Mike Williams, who's sort of this everyman at the heart of it. He's working with Kurt Russell's Mr. Jimmy, who keep highlighting as the standout of this film with his big old bushy moustache. He's very, very good. And then you've also got Kate Hudson on board as Wahlberg's wife in the film. It's really, really interesting for Berg because it's really sort of technical, and this film was meant to be by J.C. Chandor, who did Margin Call, up until quite late in the day. So the fact that Berg's come on board and completely turned around Chandor's vision is insane, and it's a massive testament to the director. And although we sort of know him for the big explosive stuff, and yes, the final third is very big and very explosive, I think this does show quite an interesting other side to him.
Mm.
There's some really interesting shots sort of just tracking along through the rig, looking at different parts of the rig and what they do, and they're quite silent, which I think for Berg a lot of people don't really expect. It's just a really, really interesting film. Everyone's sort of giving it their absolute all. You've got Malkovich playing a BP executive who is just doing his, you know, sort of John Malkovich doing what he does best, basically.
Yeah, basically, yeah.
And
Cajun John Malkovich. Amazing accent.
Yes.
Yeah.
It is a really interesting accent, isn't it? And yeah, you've got people like Dylan O'Brien from The Maze Runner in there. There's also
Gina Rodriguez is very good from Jane the Virgin.
She is.
Smaller role, but really good. I was actually on set of this, and I have to say, they essentially built an oil rig in a forest near New Orleans because they weren't allowed on any oil rigs. For some reason,
sure,
the oil companies weren't too keen on this film being made. And they built a full-size oil rig almost, I think 85%, in a huge tank of water. And they were so obsessed with getting sort of verisimilitude and using lots of real equipment from salvage. I mean, the level of detail is extraordinary. And the whole process for Peter Berg was to try and represent these men faithfully. He wasn't, you know, he's like, we've all heard about the environmental disaster. We know that happened. Let's talk about the human disaster that also happened. And I thought that was kind of an interesting approach. And I'm not going to review it because I was on set, but I think in that sense, I think they've succeeded. They had all the families of the dead men come to visit the set, or at least many of them. People brought photos, mementos, and I think that sort of care for the people kind of shines through.
Yeah,
which is good.
It could not be further away from Battleship, which is
yes.
No, but seriously, like, that's a really, he can make a really, I know a lot of people think it's, you know, too on the nose, but for me, I absolutely lost it during the end of this film, and I think it's incredibly moving, and I think it's a really beautiful tribute personally.
I thought he handled the first hour or so of it really, really well. Mm. I think the setup is great.
Yeah.
You know, there's some pretty heavy-handed bits of foreshadowing.
Yeah.
The daughter who, you know, demonstrates what might potentially go wrong if you have a large amount of pressure from the ground up, the seabed up, getting out of control early on, which is an interestingly prophetic moment. The sort of establishing the characters is very, very good. And you know, it's obviously jargony, but it's okay. You know, you just let them talk about spigots and whatnot and just sit back.
Interestingly, even the word mud is actually jargon for something that isn't technically mud.
Interesting.
In this case, yeah.
I didn't know that. I haven't seen the film. Okay.
There is a lot in there, isn't there?
It doesn't talk down to you and it doesn't sort of exposit lots of stuff at you, which is good. I think where it kind of slightly was less effective is in the second half of the story when the explosions happened. It's a tension break in itself, I suppose, and then you're just into survival mode. The problem with it being a true story is you can't really deviate from what happened.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, the Urban Allen movies, Towering Inferno, you could go wild with what happens to the characters because it's fictional. But here you sort of has to follow, you know, the actual events, and consequently, you know, it's chaotic and it's just fire everywhere. You can barely catch sight or work out who's who anymore, and no one really has any sort of, there's not really any kind of progression. I don't know if you felt that, but
I did. It felt rushed at that point. It just felt quite quick.
Yeah,
I don't know. In
it
a
did
way
feel
that,
rushed. I thought there'd be more of that kind of Towering Inferno style towel over the head, trying to get from A to B, and there's a bit of that, but inevitably that's not what happened.
Yeah. I mean, partly because these guys were good and they knew the evacuation procedures and they knew, you know, what to do, and they're not sort of clueless civilians on a cruise ship. But so it's a tribute to them. But yeah, I mean, as cinema, it does give yourself a bit of a problem, I guess.
You want at least one sort of Ernest Borgnine character who's just kind of just feeling his way through the stuff for the first time.
Yeah, I think
you're right. They're all very professional.
So we gave that
four stars,
which is very much a recommendation.
Absolutely.
So yeah, might be worth a look this week.
Yeah.
Staying with real life, there's a film version this week of the Obamas' first date. So Barack and Michelle Obama have talked in the past on the record about their first date, and the makers of South Side With You have essentially extrapolated from that a film. And it's a sort of before sunrise type walking through a scenic city kind of a film, in this case Chicago, and two people laying out their kind of philosophies on life and love and work and race and politics and trying to figure each other out. I mean, the difference in this case, of course, is that they go on to become the President and First Lady of the United States of America.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, not to the best of my knowledge what happened to any of Richard Linklater's characters. Although, hey, I'm keeping an eye on those Everybody Wants Some guys.
Yes.
So yeah, I quite enjoyed this, even though it's massively on the nose quite often. There's a lot of quite specific foreshadowing of stuff that will come up in their politics later on in life. But it's quite charming all the same. I think they've done a really good job with the casting, particularly of Barack Obama, who was still going by Barry a lot at this stage. It's kind of nice when it's playing its hand quite lightly and when you see the glimmerings of something to come, but not necessarily the fully fledged kind of presidential figure in the making. So fair play to them. Tika Sumpter and Parker Sawyers are the two stars, and I think they do really, really well. But yeah, it's just a little bit too on the nose for real greatness. There's another Barack Obama film coming out called Barry, which I haven't seen yet, but which I also hear great things about, so I'll be checking that out.
Such a catchy name, isn't it?
I know. But this one we gave 3 stars, which I think is fair.
Barry.
Yeah.
You Barry. Do look at it and think that feels like it might be a sort of TV movie, but it's slightly better than that, isn't it?
It is. And I think they, you know, they do make the most of the Chicago locations, you know, spectacular art museums, beautiful parks, that kind of thing. It made me want to go on holiday. But it's just that little bit less subtle than I think you want it to be in this kind of situation. So yeah, I mean, in the realm of presidential biopics, I would put it well ahead of Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter, but perhaps a little bit behind
biopics,
say Lincoln. You know, so
yeah, we all know he was definitely a vampire hunter.
Films that don't make you want to go on holiday this week include Under the Shadow.
Yes, tell me more.
Which is really interesting because
I saw it a little while ago, and it's subsequently been picked as Britain's entry for
Best Foreign
Language Academy Award, which is unusual, I would say,
because it's
Directed by Babak Anvari, who is Iranian-born but raised in Britain, so classifies as a British filmmaker, and he's made a fantastic movie. I have to say, it's a horror movie first and foremost. It's set at the end of the 80s, in the height of the Iran-Iraq War, and set in a sort of apartment block in Tehran, and revolves around a mother, Narges Rashidi, and her young daughter, who is, I think, sort of 5, 6, 7, in that kind of a ballpark.
Okay.
And her husband gets drafted as a doctor to go away and serve at the front, leaving her and her daughter at home. They're kind of sort of in the middle class bracket, I guess, and she does things that you're not supposed to do. She's pretty one of the sort of liberal lifestyle. She has Jane Fonda workout videos, which she has to hide, which she exercises to every evening in front of the TV. The kind of things that really do get you in trouble with the authorities, which becomes a bit of a plot point, her kind of reluctance to conform. But what this is basically is a horror movie that kind of it's kind of takes in inspiration, I think, from sort of Arabian Nights. I don't want to give too much away about what the sort of menace is, but effectively there's a haunting. Everything's reasonably okay, but there is a backdrop of a bombing, a missile bombing campaign by Iraq on Tehran. So people are fleeing the country, fleeing the city, but she won't leave. She wants to stay there, but gradually her building becomes more and more sort of a haunted house, effectively, in some ways. And then one day suddenly a missile rains through the roof of the flat above her. And with it, the implication, some malevolent spirit. So it's a really, really interesting kind of backdrop to a horror movie, and the period detail is captured very finely. The performance by Narges Rashidi is fantastic, and her younger daughter, because it's really a two-hander for the most part. The jump scares are there, but they're sparingly used. It's really a piece about mood and atmosphere, and it's got plenty of both. We've given it 5 stars, and as the review makes clear, Kim Newman's review, that it's subtler than sort of an Insidious movie, but it is a really interesting film about mother-daughter relationship, and it's scary.
Awesome.
I mean, I'm easily scared.
Yeah.
But it's scary, even if you're less easily scared than me, I think. Well, it's hard to say because I'm just me, so I don't know. But it scared me, and I really like the setting. It's very much it doesn't just have period detail. It really uses it to heighten the horror.
Wow.
In interesting ways. So 5 stars. Go see.
Definitely. We also gave 5 stars this week to Swiss Army Man, which is the film with Daniel Radcliffe playing a corpse. Now, that premiered at Empire Live last week, but sadly, we were all running around like headless chickens, not actually watching it. So none of us in the booth have seen it. But Chris is a huge fan. He wrote the review, and we would definitely recommend it. He absolutely loved it, as did Terry, actually. She was raving about it the other day as well. Speaking of Empire Live, you may also remember that we had a certain insanely handsome podcast guest who came in to talk to us about his new TV show. Not Tom Bennett, although he is
so
too
handsome.
Insanely handsome, but Mike Coulter, who came in to talk about Luke Cage. And that, of course, goes live on Netflix as you're listening to this today, Friday the 30th.
Yeah.
So you can see it now. Now, we've only seen the first half so far, but it is definitely worth your time. For my money, it is at least the second best Netflix show. Netflix Marvel show. Netflix Marvel show so far. So I would put it on the basis of the first half, I would put it just behind Daredevil season 1 and comfortably ahead of Jessica Jones and Daredevil season 2.
Them fighting was.
So yeah, that's right, I'm going there. So but really, really good. Great sense of place, incredible music. We also have a feature on that one in the new issue of Empire. We talked about it in the live podcast, but that is now on shelves everywhere. You can go and physically buy it, even if you're not at Empire Live. It is there, and it is definitely worth reading Dan's piece on that, because he goes into a great amount of detail with the showrunner, Cho Hadari Coker, and the stars, and it's a fascinating insight to the series without being spoilerific, importantly. We haven't got the review yet because we're waiting to see a bit more, so that will be online hopefully on Monday. We think it'll be online on Monday. So if you want to wait to watch it to read the review first, I'm sorry, it will be then. And on that bombshell, it is time for us to say goodbye. Join us next week for more film-related fun, when we will be joined by two more fantastic guests, separately this time, not together. Luke Evans is coming in to talk about The Girl on the Train, mm-hmm. his new film, and we'll probably ask him about other stuff as well. And Andrea Arnold is coming in to talk about her latest directorial effort, American Honey, which is a fantastic film that I like a lot. Until then, it's goodbye from Emma.
Goodbye.
It's goodbye from Phil.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me. I'm off to get Phil to give me the benefit of his college education on segues, apparently. Yeah. So,
yep. Yeah. Teach you some Lion King songs too, if you're lucky.
Oh, I look forward to all those three lyrics that you can remember. Thanks. See you next week.